This hour's top stories. U.S. authorities are investigating hundreds of potential leads following an explosion in Nashville, which damaged several buildings in the city's downtown area. Several European countries confirmed the emergence of a new variant of COVID-19 a week after the UK announced that the new strain is spreading rapidly through southern England. Also in the headlines, three UN peacekeepers are killed by unidentified combatants in the Central African Republic as the country prepares for a general election. Welcome to the program. U.S. federal agents are investigating over 500 leads in search for an explanation for the blast that rocked the city of Nashville on Friday. Hundreds of agents and local police officers are involved in the probe of the huge explosion that destroyed several vehicles and damaged more than 40 businesses. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motorhome in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn, while police say they have found possible human remains near the site of the blast. No fatalities have been confirmed yet. Officials have also stated that the explosion appears to be an intentional act. The city's mayor has ordered a curfew around the site of the explosion. Colin Campbell joined us earlier to give us an update on the explosion in Nashville, Tennessee.
Police don't want to overextend themselves when it comes to details about this case. Now, they have narrowed down one person that they believe could be responsible for this blast. This was a man who owned an RV that was similar to the one seen in video just before the explosion in downtown Nashville. This was a guy who owned this RV and was picked up by a Google Maps camera. Yes, that's right. Those cameras and cars that you may see from either a satellite or roving around your neighborhood, when they pick up certain images, they pick up vehicles, they pick up mailboxes, they pick up how houses look. Well, this was an RV that was sitting in the driveway of this man of interest's house. And so they went to this person's house. They are questioning him. They really aren't disclosing his name, although I do believe there is a name being released on the internet of a person in his 60s who's being questioned in this explosion. And again, this is only because this particular individual had an RV that was similar to the one that was seen in the video just before the explosion. And they believe that tracing back, looking at these photographs, they may have the right person. Now, again, this person is a person of interest. This is not a suspect, at least not right now. Police are not indicating that anyone was killed in the explosion. Before, there were some early reports that there were some human remains found from the explosion, but police are now saying that they don't believe anyone was seriously injured, or rather, anyone was killed in this, although there were some people that did report some injury.
One in every 1,000 Americans has now died from COVID-19, as the U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic. With a population of over 330 million, the U.S. has so far witnessed some more than 331,000 deaths related to the coronavirus. Health officials in the country have also registered over 18.9 million confirmed cases. This comes as officials are bracing for a surge in infections following Christmas holidays. Meanwhile, the Central and Southern California regions have both run out of intensive care units. The state of California alone has so far reported over 2 million cases of COVID-19. Now, the discovery of a faster-spreading strain of COVID-19 has heightened concerns in the EU, where a vaccination campaign is being kicked off. Our correspondent in Brussels and Barcelona brought us up to speed with the latest surrounding of the pandemic on the continent. Take a listen, please.
And now several nations are reporting cases of new coronavirus strain, which was first identified in the United Kingdom. Cases infected with the faster spreading COVID-19 variant were found in Spain, Sweden, France, Switzerland, Australia, and Canada. Now, all the infections were linked to people who had arrived from the UK. discovery of the new variant of the respiratory disease prompted dozens of countries to restrict all travel to and from Britain. Several members of the European Union have started a vaccine rollout in an attempt to rein in the highly contagious disease. So far, more than 80 million people have tested positive for COVID-19 globally. The pandemic has claimed over 1.7 million lives worldwide. And joining us now for this news review is Jerome Hughes from Brussels and Kusai Kedri, our correspondent there in Barcelona. Gentlemen, hope you're both doing well and safe. And I guess we'll start with you, Jerome, in Brussels. Tell us what's going on where you're at.
Yeah, Daniel. Well, obviously, this new strain is causing concern, and you've listed some of the countries where the most recent countries that have confirmed the new strain, Spain, Switzerland, and Sweden among them. As you mentioned, all of the cases, also Japan as well, all of the cases identified, it was linked to travel from the UK. So it identifies to us once again that travel is an issue in terms of this COVID-19 and in terms of how it does spread, even though we know the aviation industry does say that it's safe to travel because of the aircraft, the changing of the air and so on. But even so, it's just the case physically, people moving from one area to another does spread the virus. And it's also estimated that up to two-thirds now of the cases of COVID-19 that are being identified or confirmed in southern England are actually this new strain, this new variant on the actual virus itself. And so that's a very high figure, although the experts say that, you know, it's the strength of the surveillance system in England that's why they're able so readily to identify this new strain. And it may not have actually originated there at all, but other countries now are actually getting better in terms of identifying it. It is a concern. It is obviously more contagious, but the doctors are saying that it's not more dangerous on an individual basis. You know, so, but having said that, of course, we do know that the more people get COVID-19, so if it's spreading more quickly, if it's more contagious, then obviously we're going to have higher rates of people in hospital. Also, then we'll have the higher death figures as well. So from that point of view, obviously, it is a concern. But also that we're hearing now that the vaccination programs are being rolled out, as you mentioned, also, you know, already in Germany and Hungary, for example, in the European Union, the new vaccines are being rolled out. Also, within this next several hours, on Sunday, we're expecting that France, Italy, and Spain will begin their vaccination programs. And then the rest of the European Union, the other countries, will also do the same during the coming week. So it's actually happening pretty quick. The problem at the moment, of course, is just literally having enough of the vaccine. For example, the one that's been approved in the European Union, the Pfizer vaccine, it's a case of just having enough of it. But as more vaccines come online, then obviously more people will get it and we can try and overcome the problem. But the reality is as well, it's important to say that the good news is that the experts, the epidemiologists, the scientists are saying that they do believe that the vaccines will be effective against this new strain. So obviously that's a very positive thing, but again, it's just a case of trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible. And obviously as well, Daniel, there is a lot of concern at the moment in terms of people congregating during the holiday period, Christmas, New Year. People are outside their normal bubbles. They're congregating indoors in domestic situations because the nightlife is closed down in many, many countries. Strict lockdown in terms of travel, in terms of who you can meet. But we do know anecdotally and in reality, so many people are meeting in large numbers in houses, in apartments, over this festive period.
Thank you, Jerome and Kusai. I'd like to welcome you to the program. I should add, and we've heard that before, a few specialists said with respect to the vaccine that it will most likely work on this new strain, but a lot of experts have also said eventually, just like the flu, there is going to become a point where a new strain is going to evolve or a variant that's going to be resistant to this vaccine. So that just shows how serious it is to get more people vaccinated globally as soon as possible, basically get to some kind of level of herd immunity. Kusai, what I'd like to know, I know there's about three or four, possibly five passengers that arrived from the UK in your neck of the woods with this new variant. Tell us what authorities, how concerned they are with respect to that. And if you could, like Jerome, to walk us through efforts of the Madrid government there and what it's doing with respect to mass vaccination of Spaniards.
Yes, Danny, the officials in Madrid have repeated the same claims or the same statements made in Brussels, in the sense that they tried to play down public fear over the spread of this new strain of the virus, saying that though it may be very infectious, it is less lethal. And they urge citizens to, residents in Spain, to lower their mobility, particularly ahead of the New Year festivity. The patients who tested positive were Spanish nationals returning from the UK over this past week, Thursday to be precise. One of them has eventually reportedly infected his own family, his own mom and sister, who have tested positive, and he and the whole family is in quarantine. The other case is being investigated, but in both cases, authorities here say that these are Spanish nationals returning to Spain from the UK. There hasn't been any more information as to the spread of this ultimate spread of the virus, but authorities insist that the best way to counter or limit the spread is to follow the regulations and restrictions in place. This, as the country is getting ready to deploy the first vaccine tomorrow, Sunday, across the 17 regions.
Gentlemen, I want to wish both of you the happy holidays, a very Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year. And until we speak to both of you again, do stay safe, please, and enjoy these holidays as safely as you can with your families. Jerome Hughes there joining us from Brussels, and Kusai Kedri Kusai joining us there out of Barcelona. And that's a wrap for this segment of your news review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. The United Nations says three UN peacekeepers have been killed by unidentified combatants in the Central African Republic. The UN says the victims were from Burundi, adding that two other peacekeepers were also wounded in the incident. It said the assaults took place in the towns of Dekoa and Bakuma. A spokesman for the UN Secretary General strongly condemned the, quote, heinous attacks and called on the authorities in the Central African Republic to investigate the incident. This comes as the country prepares for a general election amid ongoing clashes between rebels and government forces. Political commentator Mr. Abayomi Azakiwe says foreign forces have not allowed the Central African Republic to gain total sovereignty and independence in the past decades.
It is a country historically where there have been intense power struggles taking place between various factions inside the country. Although the population there is less than 5 million people, it's still a very rich nation in terms of its resources. They have timber, they have gold, they have diamonds, as well as uranium. France also is the former colonial master there, and they have still not allowed the country to gain total sovereignty and independence for the last 60 years when they were granted independence in 1960. Russia has signed a security agreement as well as an economic agreement with the government of President Trudeau. Nonetheless, it doesn't seem to be enough to stabilize the situation ahead of these elections, and the second phase of the elections is going to be taking place in February.
1 year has passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and resistance icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondents have talked to a number of Syrian and Palestinian people about the assassination. Let's see what they had to say.
Qasem Soleimani sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and spent his life fighting for Palestine. His legacy will never die because thousands more Soleimanis will be born and a new night will lead the way.
His memory will remain forever in the hearts of Palestinians and Iranians. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was especially harsh for all of us in Gaza who remain under siege. The absence of Qasem Soleimani has encouraged Arabs to normalize their relations with our enemy. His martyrdom was a great loss for Palestinians who will find it harder to liberate their land. Since his martyrdom, Israel has stepped up its aggression and siege against the Palestinians.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of devotion and sacrifice for Syrian people. The services he did are unforgettable. He will remain in the memories of the coming generations in Syria. Words cannot describe his efforts and his sacrifices.
Qasem Soleimani.
May he rest in peace. He was a commander and a hero, a big hero, and a symbol of his steadfastness and sacrifice for us, especially here in Syria. I congratulate him on his martyrdom. Not all people are worthy of such martyrdom. The U.S. did not achieve anything from his assassination, because one Qasem Soleimani is gone, but 10 other Qasem Soleimanis will come. He stood alongside Syrians from Aleppo to Damascus. My brothers fought under his directives. They were ordinary fighters, but they told me he used to dine and spend time with them. He was so down to earth.
Soleimani was not the first and will not be the last resistance figure. The path of resistance on the way of Imam Hussein will live forever until liberating the last inch of every occupied land. Soleimani was a fighter, a struggler. May he rest in peace. He stood beside us. There are hundreds of others like Soleimani.
Israelis have held a fresh demonstration against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. The demonstration was held despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. Israeli army has carried out fresh airstrikes against Gaza Strip, targeting several residential areas of the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit is in Gaza.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and 2 civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. We will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resisting groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A report released recently by the International Rescue Committee, which includes testimonies from 904 participants of the International Rescue Committee health programs from camps on the Greek island of Lesbos, Chios, and Samos, showed that after the first coronavirus lockdown in March, there was a 71% increase in the number of people experiencing psychotic symptoms and a 66% increase in self-harm. Anna Schlegel, who started Medical Volunteers International's program working with children on the island of Lesbos, says emotional instability is common among the children that they treat. Anna Schlegel says they will get either very aggressive or sad from 1 minute to the next. Among our 32 child patients, issues also include stuttering and sleepwalking. Schlegel notes, children have also started using self-harm to get rid of tension and the overwhelming emotions they face through the re-traumatization, adding that the Moria fire on 8th of September still weighed heavily on some children. She said, one boy we have in our group was always focused on fire. If he'd see a building, he would focus on it and ask how it would look if it was burning down. We now present you an article written jointly by Katie Fallon and Franzika Grillmeier under the heading, A Mental Health Emergency, No End to Trauma for Refugees on Lesbos. The article has been taken from the website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Nadia hasn't slept. The mother of five spent the night trying to soothe her seven-year-old son, Martin, who is autistic, while heavy rain fell on the family's tent. He was crying and asking for the noise to stop. She says, I tried to explain to him that the rain is not in our control, adding, but in these moments you can't reach him anymore. The family, originally from Parwan province in Afghanistan, are living in the new refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos that was built in 3 days after the fire that razed to the ground parts of the infamous Moria camp. Nadia, a 38-year-old, washes Martin, who has recently recovered from scabies, using water from a plastic bottle. She says she has seen a steady deterioration in his behavior and sleeping. She says, we can't sleep anymore, adding, I need Martin to get into a warm place. This is my only wish. A report released recently by the International Rescue Committee, which includes testimonies from 904 participants of the International Rescue Committee health programs from camps on the Greek islands of Lesbos, Chios, and Samos, showed that after the first coronavirus lockdown in March, there was a 71% increase in the number of people experiencing psychotic symptoms and a 66% increase in self-harm. Anna Schlegel, who started Medical Volunteers International's program working with children on the island of Lesbos, says emotional instability is common among the children they treat. Anna Schlegel says they will get either very aggressive or very sad from 1 minute to the next. Among our 32 child patients, issues also include stuttering and sleepwalking. Anna Schlegel notes, Children have also started using self-harm to get rid of tension and the overwhelming emotions they face through the re-traumatization, adding that the Moria fire on 8th of September still weighed heavily on some children. She said, "One boy we have in our group was always focused on fire. If he'd see a building, he would focus on it and ask how it would look if it was burning down." Thanasis Chirvatidis, a child psychologist with Médecins Sans Frontières on Lesbos, who said the parents needed to be stabilized psychologically first, says, "We have not seen a mental health care emergency like this one, even in Moria." Chirvatidis says, "If a child sees his parents giving up or being afraid, the scaffolding breaks away from them too," adding, "The children do not have the same mechanisms as adults to express their fears. Most of it surfaces during sleep." In 2020, Médecins Sans Frontières has treated 49 children on the island of Lesbos with thoughts of suicide or for suicide attempts. The current demand for Médecins Sans Frontières services is more than the organization can meet, and there is a lengthy waiting list for the pediatric clinic and the clinic for victims of torture and sexual violence. Rainfall has left parts of the camp waterlogged, and tents have been flooded on more than one occasion. Human rights organizations have raised concerns about substandard living conditions for inhabitants in the camp, dubbed Moria 2.0 by many on the ground. 36 hot water showers have just been installed, but many of the 7,300 residents still shower using buckets or water bottles. Lockdown restrictions mean that residents are only allowed to leave once a week to visit the supermarket, a lawyer, or the pharmacy. Exits are monitored and fines given out for residents not wearing face masks. Chirvatidis says many children are also afraid of the police, adding they are not perceived as protectors, but mainly as punishers. Petra Molnar from the Migration and Technology Monitor says security measures are having an impact on people's mental health. Petra Molnar says, "We're seeing the rise of surveillance technologies like drones patrolling the skies and the increased use of closed and controlled facilities like the new camp on Lesbos," adding, "This type of omnipresent surveillance and toxic ongoing stress has long-term mental health repercussions, especially for children." Lesbos is not the only Aegean island dealing with a growing mental health crisis. The island of Samos had just over 3,600 people living in an area of land designed for 648. The island was rocked by an earthquake in October, as well as by recent fires in the camp, where some residents have lost all their documents or belongings. Lindsay Solera Ducha, a Médecins Sans Frontières psychiatrist who has worked on the island of Samos for nearly 2 months, says, "Each time something like this happens, it just kind of pushes them over the edge." She says, "In November, 60% of new arrivals at their clinic expressed suicidal thoughts," adding, "It really feels like sometimes we're fighting a losing battle." Julia Sicoli from the Mazi Youth Center on the island of Samos said she had heard some students express suicidal thoughts such as, "I don't want to live anymore and I don't know when this will end." Children make up around a quarter of the population of the camp on the island of Samos, which is perched on a hill overlooking the town of Fathi. Most people sleep outside the camp boundaries, where rats, scabies, and bedbugs are a part of daily life. Julia Sicoli says people lucky enough to be housed in a container often don't have hot water, the floor is destroyed, windows or doors are missing, and the containers overcrowded. During a visit to the island of Lesbos recently, the Greek migration minister, Notis Mitsotakis, claimed the new temporary camp was in a very good state of security and order and did not compare to Moria. While European Union member states debate the resettlement of refugees from the Aegean islands, more than 14,500 people are facing another winter in island refugee camps. Nadia will continue to leave the camp once a week to take her son, Martin, to his medical appointments, packing a coloring book to keep him busy and wearing 3 jackets to stay warm.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, since people in the West are enjoying Christmas holidays, we join them in their hour of joy by reflecting upon a wise saying of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, with reference to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God the Blessed, the Exalted, says, "My faithful servants become sad when I take the worldly pleasures away from them, while this is the most lovable and the most favorable thing for me. They feel happy when I bestow upon them many worldly pleasures, while this is the most detestable and the remotest thing from me. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. All peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his family."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with clergy and the students of the seminary. Attention to other than Allah covers men with veils of darkness and light. The strongest sort of belief he might have would be not to deny the position of the saints or awliya of Allah, and not to consider as myths of the worlds of Barzakh, the Seerah, the resurrection, the counting, the book, the heaven and hell. Due to the effects of sins and the attachment of the heart to this world, one comes to gradually deny this truth, to deny the position of the saints of Allah, positions which are mentioned in not more than a few lines of prayers and intimate devotions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. Now, today I have one of his sayings in which he is basically talking to everyone who is in front of him. He is talking to the nation, to the government, to everybody, everyone. Now, in his saying, in one of his speeches, he said that, O nation, wake up. O government, wake up. Everybody, wake up. You are all in the presence of God. Tomorrow, in the next world, you will be called to account. We say, like in the Quran, it is said, like, الَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ, those who believed, they have believed on unseen. Allah, we cannot see him with these mortal eyes that we have, but he is present everywhere. So we need to make sure that we remember, and Imam Khomeini is trying to wake up his nation. He said, O nation, wake up. O the Muslim Ummah, you must wake up. O the people who are working in the government, you need to wake up. Everybody needs to wake up. That you all are in the presence of God. Why? You are in the presence of God because we are living in a place which is created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we are also the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
We are accountable for our deeds that we do, because tomorrow when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will gather us, he will ask questions. Obviously, in the Islamic Revolution, there were many people who got martyred. Even after that, the 8 years war that was opposed by the Saddam regime, in there were martyrs. Why did they give their lives? It was for a divine cause. It was for the Islam. It was for this divine revolution that was brought by Imam Khomeini. So Imam said, do not forget their blood, because if you forget their blood and you start having quarrel with each other for the positions or the status or your personal desires, then obviously you're accountable in front of them. Tomorrow on the day of judgment, they're gonna ask you, they're gonna question you, that we have given our lives for this sacred and divine cause, but after us, you guys had the fight on your own personal desires. So inshallah, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he give us the tawfiq so that we can live for a divine cause inshallah, and may we not forget the bloods of our martyrs. May we remember our martyrs all the time, and inshallah, they will help us in this world and hereafter. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day.
Every night and every day. Never forget to say, La ilaha.
In 2017, Alwin Witcher took a job with Saudi Aramco, the kingdom's oil giant. 3 years later, the South African engineer was buried in a landfill-like site after he died of COVID-19. His wife, Corrine, says that the Saudi oil company denied Alwin medical treatment when he first fell ill with the deadly virus in June. In her words, if they had treated him properly early on, or sent him to a proper hospital, I'm convinced he would have survived. Critics say that the tragic story of Alwin Witcher is a common phenomenon at the world's largest energy company and the backbone of the kingdom's economy.
الحادث انحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Whistleblowers, mainly former employees at Aramco, say the mecca for oil engineers is not what it wants to be known for. For years, many foreigners would like to work at Aramco to enjoy its high salaries and big bonuses. They say bullying and mistreatment of expatriates, mismanagement, and racism are the current realities on the ground. The company has laid off hundreds of foreign workers, restricted overtime pay and holiday leave. Insiders say they have to work more for less. As a result of the coronavirus pandemic, Saudi Aramco has had to cut corners. This has affected the safety of the employees. According to a current worker at the company's Jizan refinery project, who spoke to Financial Times on condition of anonymity, the way it's going, this refinery runs a real risk of becoming Saudi Arabia's Piper Alpha, referring to the 1988 disaster that killed 167 workers on a North Sea oil rig. There has been a multitude of sins. People have been pressured to sign off work without the proper systems checks. It's got inherent issues that have been covered up or patched over that pose a real safety risk.
With Aramco, which, as I said, one of the richest companies in the world, you know, this is a terrible. It shows that their priorities are misplaced. And, of course, also it indicates they're under a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. They're having, you know, some serious reduction in the amount of money they have. And, of course, they're being pressured by the Crown Prince and other Saudi officials to, you know, to get rid of foreign workers and to nationalize their economy. But in the rush to do so, they are taking risks, and these people are not necessarily skilled, and of course they don't like criticism. So like many other people in countries, they think they know everything, but that is not the case, especially when you're dealing with a highly technical and dangerous industry like the oil extraction industry.
Some say the mistreatment of the expatriates at Saudi Aramco is the result of the Saudi Crown Prince's Saudization of the kingdom's workforce. In 2019, youth unemployment was above 30%. It was in 2016 that Mohammed bin Salman told The Economist there are 10 million jobs that are being occupied by non-Saudi employees in the kingdom that I can resort to at any time of my choosing. This obvious change of attitude towards expats has undermined their safety at work.
In Aramco, which is, you know, the first or second richest company in the world, you would think that they would be able to look after their workers. In the past, they have, but there's, I guess, a series of problems that Aramco is facing. One is the severe decline in the price of oil. Secondly, you have the Saudization program from the Crown Prince, who wants to hire more Saudis and get rid of as much as 10% of the foreign workforce each year, which is a good goal. But they're trying to do it too quickly, and it's creating problems because the people aren't qualified to do the job, and they're in a rush to please their employers. And the facility at Jizan was supposed to have been finished in 2016, and it's not.
The Jizan refinery, Aramco's mega project that started in 2012, is a case in point. Whistleblowers say the project has been beset with problems, such as subsidence of foundations and cracks in the refinery structure, which can be highly dangerous for those working there. According to another worker at Saudi Aramco, I truly never believed that coming to Saudi Arabia to work for the world's biggest oil and gas producer to help them construct a refinery the magnitude of Jizan could end so badly. Another employee says that working at Aramco is a matter of life and death. as the Saudi security forces cannot protect the company against the Yemenis, with whom Riyadh has been at war since 2015. A British engineer, who introduced himself as Michael Redding, not his real name, told the Financial Times that he was forced to leave Saudi Aramco to protect his health. Witness to a missile attack at Jazan, which is close to the Yemen border, he was diagnosed with early-stage post-traumatic stress disorder. The doctor warned that if I went back to Jazan, I would get PTSD I would find it hard to recover from. He continued, after the missile attack, you look with fresh eyes and realize we're on the verge of a war zone, but there's little provision in place for workers' safety. I asked, what provisions are you making for our safety? And they'd rub their hands together and say, God willing, it'll be fine. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic has made the situation even worse at Aramco. According to whistleblowers, there are no screening of workers arriving at the site after trips, making it a major vector for infection. That level of indifference from the management has shocked many at Saudi Aramco. In the words of one of the employees, you couldn't get a test unless you were at death's door. Meanwhile, engineers from Europe or North America are reportedly provided with better medical care and accommodation, while those hailing from Asian countries such as Bangladesh and Pakistan are almost neglected.
Unfortunately, I think it's a widespread problem within Saudi management, even in the other workers, that they tend to have a racist attitude and discriminate against blacks, you know, Bangladeshis, Filipinos, other workers, especially who are not sort of, you know, white from the United States and Canada and Britain. So yes, there is a big problem, and obviously they made a big error, which not only if he's contagious, he's spreading it to other workers, and they should have moved quickly on it. So their negligence, quite frankly, has resulted in the death of this individual, but probably also in many other people being infected with COVID-19, which is, you know, a very bad policy and even, you know, criminally negligent. So yes, I think this is a terrible example, and you know, the Saudis and the Saudi medical officials and Aramco and other companies need to be much more vigilant and take urgent steps to prevent the spread of COVID and to protect the workers, quite frankly.
Despite all the inhumane conditions, those who work at Saudi Aramco daren't speak out. They say it might cost them their jobs. They also say it's a waste of time and energy to file a lawsuit against the company inside the kingdom, as the major shareholders are the Saudi royals, who regard themselves as being above the law.
Yes, it'd be almost impossible to win a legal battle because the system is compromised. Most of the shareholders are, of course, Saudi members of the Saudi royal family, and there also is this sort of arrogance that you know, the Saudis have, that they are dismissive of foreign workers and that they know everything and they're great, even though they really haven't had the experience, they haven't got the proper culture to avoid problems and to take proactive measures to prevent them. And as a result, Western employees and other employees are very concerned, and this is going to have, you know, I think long-term negative implications for, you know, the Saudi royal family and for Arabia and for its oil industry.
Saudi Aramco is by far the best place expatriates can work inside the kingdom. If this is the situation there, what is it like in other places inside Saudi Arabia?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At noon on 20th of January, presuming he doesn't have to be dragged out of the White House as a trespasser, Donald Trump will make one last walk across the South Lawn, take his seat inside Marine One, and be gone. From that moment, Trump's rambunctious term as President of the United States will be over. But in one important aspect, the challenge presented by his presidency will have only just begun. The possibility that he will face prosecution for crimes committed before he took office or whilst in the Oval Office. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, How Real is the Threat of Prosecution for Donald Trump Post-Presidency? Stay with us for more of Ed Pilkington's article. Noon on 20th of January, presuming he doesn't have to be dragged out of the White House as a trespasser, Donald Trump will make one last walk across the South Lawn, take his seat inside Marine One, and be gone. From that moment, Trump's rambunctious term as President of the United States will be over, but in one important aspect, the challenge presented by his presidency will have only just begun. The possibility that he will face prosecution for crimes committed before he took office or whilst in the Oval Office. You've never had a president before who has invited so much scrutiny, said Bob Bauer, the White House counsel under Barack Obama. This has been a very eventful presidency that raises hard questions about what happens when Trump leaves office. For the past 4 years, Trump has been shielded from legal jeopardy by a Justice Department memo that rules out criminal prosecution of a sitting president. But the second he boards that presidential helicopter and fades into the horizon, all bets are off. The Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance is actively investigating Trump's business dealings. The focus described in court documents is extensive and protracted criminal conduct at the Trump Organization, including possible bank fraud. A second major investigation by the fearsome federal prosecutors of the Southern District of New York has already led to the conviction of Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations relating to the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels, who alleged an affair with Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. During the course of the prosecution, Michael Cohen implicated a certain individual one, thought to be Donald Trump, as the mastermind behind the felony. Though the investigation was technically closed last year, charges could be revisited once Donald Trump's effective immunity is lifted. It all points to a momentous and fiendishly difficult legal challenge fraught with political danger for the incoming Biden administration. Should Donald Trump be investigated and possibly prosecuted for crimes committed before and during his presidency? It looks like the incoming administration will have to confront some form of these issues, said Bob Bauer, who is co-author of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. The government is going to have decisions to make about how to respond, given the potential that it becomes a source of division. Any attempt to hold Trump criminally liable in a federal prosecution would be a first in U.S. history. No exiting president has ever been pursued in such a way by his successor. Richard Nixon was spared the ordeal by Gerald Ford's contentious presidential pardon. Previous presidents have tended to take the view that it is better to look forward in the name of national healing than backwards at the failings of their predecessor. And for good reasons. Any prosecution will probably be long and difficult, act as a huge distraction, and expose the incoming president to accusations that they were acting like a tin pot dictator hounding their political enemy. That a possible Trump prosecution is being discussed at all is a sign of the exceptional nature of the past 4 years. Those who argue in favor of legal action accept that there are powerful objections to going after Trump, but urge people to think about the alternative, the dangers of inaction. If you do nothing, you are saying that though the President of the United States is not above the law, in fact he is. And that would set a terrible precedent for the country and send a message to any future president that there is no effective check on their power, said Andrew Weissman, who was a lead prosecutor in Robert Mueller investigation looking into coordination between Russia and Trump's 2016 campaign. As head of one of the three main teams answering to the special counsel Robert Mueller, Andrew Weissman had a ringside seat on what he calls Trump's lawless White House. In his new book, Where Law Ends, he argues that the prevailing view of the 45th president is that following the rules is optional and that breaking them comes at minimal, if not zero, cost. Andrew Weissman told The Guardian that there would be a price to be paid if that attitude went unchallenged once Donald Trump leaves office. One of the things we learned from this presidency was that our system of checks and balances is not as strong as we thought, and that would be exacerbated by not holding him to account. Bob Bauer, White House counsel under Barack Obama and an advisor to Joe Biden during the presidential campaign, who has no role in the transition team, is also worried that a sort of double immunity would be established. Presidents cannot be prosecuted whilst in office under Justice Department rules. But under such a double immunity, nor could they be prosecuted once they leave the White House in the interests of national healing. And so the president is immune coming and going, and I think that would be very difficult to square with the idea that he or she is not above the law. Joe Biden has made clear his lack of enthusiasm for prosecuting Donald Trump, saying it would be probably not very good for democracy. But he has also made clear that he would leave that decision to his appointed attorney general, following the norm of Justice Department independence that Donald Trump has repeatedly shattered. Other prominent Democrats have taken a more bullish position, adding pressure on the incoming Attorney General to be aggressive. During the Democratic primary debates, Elizabeth Warren called for an independent task force